She inspires, educates, and informs. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. We are disruptors for good. We're game changers. We do the good thing, the right thing, not just for ourselves, but for all beings who call the Earth home. Thanks so much for listening and for being a part of this world of ours. And a big shout out and thanks to the sponsor of this show, the Chapman Automotive Group. As business leaders, they are committed to doing their share and showing they care about their employees, their community, and the planet. Their Community Green Team is a model for corporate stewardship from the inside out, and I can wax poetic about that. They do lots for the community and to soften or lighten their carbon footprint. For more information about Chapman and to learn about the myriad of fuel-efficient cars they sell, please visit them at chapmantucson.com, and we thank them for their support. I believe that today's show is perhaps one of the most important ones I've ever done in 10 years. Given that climate change is the biggest threat we have ever faced as a civilization, Mrs. Green's World has consistently been committed to raising awareness about the clear and present danger of climate change and to providing solutions, thoughts, ideas, calls to action for all of us to do our part to combat it. For the next hour, we'll be hearing from two people who have been intimately involved in putting together the most comprehensive plan ever proposed to reverse global warming, Paul Hawken and Catherine Wilkinson. The result of their effort is Project Drawdown. It is the playbook for the urgent goal of re-sequestering carbon by identifying and researching dynamic, innovative solutions. Paul is the executive director for Project Drawdown and is an author and an activist. He has founded successful ecologically conscious businesses and consulted with heads of states and CEOs on economic development, industrial ecology, and environmental policy. He has written seven books, seven books, including four national bestsellers, and I actually think it's five. The Next Economy, Growing a Business, and The Ecology of Commerce, and Blessed Unrest, and now Project Drawdown, New York Times bestseller list. Catherine Wilkinson was the senior writer for Project Drawdown, and I'll be sharing information about her many accomplishments in our second segment. Paul, thank you for being here, and thank you for all the important work you are doing on our behalf.
Good morning. Thank you so much. I am very grateful to be on your program.
Well, you have no idea how sorry I was. I missed you at Green Biz, but there'll be another time because I missed you at Bioneers too. So it's like the elusive butterfly, but I'll catch you at Pachamama, I hope, to just shake your hand. So when I'm asked to describe Project Drawdown, and it would probably surprise you how much I weave it into conversations, even socially, it's a challenge for me to describe it. I tell people that the book contains inspirational science-based solutions from around the globe. Sometimes I don't get that wordy, that have the potential not only to mitigate climate change, but to actually help draw down carbon and potentially reverse global warming. Am I close? Is that a good description? I want to be spreading the good word and say it right.
Well, I think it can be said a little more simply. Which is that most of the language around climate change is, I think, incorrect. First of all, it's not climate change we want to address. climate is supposed to change. It is a blessing. It's a miracle. It causes evolution, growth, plants, flowers, seasons. It's beautiful.
It's really important.
It's really important that climate changes like every second, and that's what it does, and it always will. It's a dynamic system. So the whole term about fighting or stopping or stemming or curbing or combating climate change is actually it's scientifically actually wrong, actually. What causes the climate to change in a way that creates instability is global warming. so that's what we have to address, which is, and the cause of global warming is us. So it's not about fighting climate change up there or weather. It's about addressing the causes down here where you and I are. So that's number one. So number two is that if we don't name the goal, then that chance we're going to achieve it. And the goal has been and is often stated as mitigating and or stemming or curbing or words like that. And mitigation means to reduce the pain and seriousness of something. And I can't imagine why we would think that that was an adequate goal given the auguries of climate scientists in terms of what will happen to hydrologic cycle, to droughts, to sea level rise, to loss of biodiversity, to et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's just unimaginable that we want to mitigate that. Actually, we want to stop it and reverse it. And so Project Drawdown set out to determine whether that was possible. I mean, I certainly didn't know, and I don't think anyone else did because no one was talking about it, first of all. And second, even though what is called climate change, but global warming has been in the public sphere for 50 years now, no one ever did what we set out and did do eventually, which is to map, measure, model the 100 most substantive solutions to reversing global warming. And when we say map, measure, model, we mean solutions that are in place, that we understand very well, that have peer-reviewed science that determines their impact. There's only two things you can do about the atmosphere, which is stop putting greenhouse gases up there, which is avoided emissions, and bring them back home, which is called biosequestration. And using economic data that came from the most respected international institutions in the world, the International Energy Agency, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the World Bank, Bloomberg Energy, FAO, etc., and putting those together, we then determined or, you know, basically did a sort and measured, you know, the top solutions and their impact. And as I said, all of them are scaling. They're extant. They're in place. We know how to do them. This isn't wannabes. These are things we know how to do and do very well. And so what we did is continue to scale them over three decades to 2050 from 2020 and see what impact they would have. And could we, in fact, by 2050, achieve drawdown, which is that point in time when greenhouse gases peak and go down on a year-to-year basis. And so that's Project Drawdown. And in order to do that, we needed a lot of people to help us.
Yeah, a lot of people. And when you're talking, I think of the magnitude and scope of this work. And, I mean, you were the inspiration for making it happen. I remember hearing you at Bioneers a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. when it was like it was full on, you know, going on. But I think, where do you start? Like, do you? we don't have to go into that, but like, this is a big, big global effort.
Yeah, well, one of the blessings we had at the outset when we created the organization was that nobody would fund us. And that sounds like, you know, like
that was a good thing.
It was a good thing. Because when you have money, you tend to sign checks to solve problems. But when you don't have money, then you have to solve them other ways. And so we could not have afforded a staff of researchers and postdocs and scientists to do this. So we put the word out to great educational institutions around the world for research fellows, drawdown research fellows. And we were just overwhelmed with applications from extraordinary people, White House fellows and Rhodes Scholars and Fulbright Scholars, and from 22 countries, 6 continents, they were chosen, and they became the core research team for Project Drawdown. And then we also had 120-some-odd advisors, botanists, biologists, engineers, architects, politicians, artists, activists, business people, who then weighed in on the content and then we had about 40 outside expert scientific reviewers of the model itself, and which is complicated systems dynamic model. And so we had a lot of input and a lot of help, and so essentially it's, I call it a wee book. It's a do book too. It's about doing, you know, but it's a wee book in a sense. It's a coalition of people who came together and in a sense reflect back to the world what we, this larger we, know and are doing. So it's not like we have this great idea, we think the world ought to do this, you know, and follow us, and we know, and, you know, read our book, and then you'll know too, and blah, blah, blah. It's just kind of like the old climate establishment model, which is, you know, sort of a white charismatic, you know, male vertebrate sort of saying, look, I know, and here's the facts, and, you know, and basically using fear or threat or gloom or doom as a way to motivate, which doesn't really work anyway, but, you know, as a way to get people to, in a sense, accede to that leadership. And that's fine, and lots of good things have come of that. I'm not criticizing it so much as saying is that it hasn't really worked. And so what we did is really model what we have to do civilizationally, which is really connect and come together to reverse global warming. It's not going to be a top-down thing. It's not going to happen because government wakes up one day, which I'm not expecting soon. It's not going to happen because there's a grassroots movement that stops things, which is great too, by the way. It's going to happen from the middle out, because people see that actually reversing global warming is in all of our best interests, not because of weather or the predictions of climate scientists, but because virtually 98% of our solutions, it turns out, are no-regret solutions that have so many benefits for children, for water, for air, for jobs, for prosperity, for health, for you know, so many positive outcomes that we would want to do these things, or
right.
are doing them.
Yes.
We would want to do them if there wasn't a climate scientist alive and we were clueless as to what was causing extreme weather. And that's the solutions. And so they really belong to everybody, and they're in everybody's self-interest.
And here's what surprised me. After all that you said about the great minds of the world coming together, many, many, many of them, scientists and researchers and, like you said, Rhodes Scholars, the brightest, it is a book for everyone. And I am telling you, I had a group of girlfriends over the other night, and one of them owns a cattle ranch. And we started talking about the book, and I said, no, Sally, that's not true. And I went, I got the book, and I gave it to her. And it's written so that people like me, lay person, I admit that I'm much more involved than the normal person because of what I do, but anybody can take this book and read about the solutions and understand the application and the benefits. And I don't know how you did that, because it's not a science book in the literal sense. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it's not science speak. It's like, this is what we can do, and the narrative is just so understandable and relatable, and I think that's important.
It's very important. I mean, the idea was that the data, like, you know, in God we trust, all others bring data. So it's very grounded. The data, the modeling was rigorous. Okay, but having said that, the story, they're all narratives about these solutions. And, like, you know, the first solar panel went up in New York City in 1884.
Yeah, they're stories.
I know, they're stories.
Yes.
And they give you a sense of connection and depth and history. And what we don't do in the book is blame, shame, demonize, point fingers.
Or preach. You don't preach.
No preaching, no threat, no gloom, no doom. It's like, come on in, you know, and it's just fascinating, you know, what we, again, I say this, we know, and what we're doing and what we've invented. LEDs go back to 1872, you know, I mean, that is diodes, you know, and so what we realize is that we're an evolving species, and we have definitely precipitated an extraordinary crisis, as you mentioned, the greatest crisis I think civilization not only has, but may ever face. And it's a really, really gnarly problem. It it actually makes the word problem seem too diminutive. And it's like, well, but within every problem is a solution in disguise. I mean, that's what a problem is. And a problem is a teaching. And so, okay, if we have this problem, so what is it telling us? As opposed to, we have to fight it, you know, we have to combat it, you know,
right.
We have to beat it, using a war metaphor, basically to stem actually what is behavior that is counterproductive to our own well-being, much less the future of the Earth.
And you have no idea how much, I mean, I've been doing this for 10 years. I do 2 interviews a week. I write a lot. I'm working on an op-ed. Your reframing the language is what I believe, but this will help me practice it more, if that makes sense. It shouldn't ever be about fear and gloom and doom, and the use of global warming, call it what it is. That's what's happening, and the Earth is heating up. So
yeah.
I'll re-listen to your show so that I can reframe even how I write about the challenge. But I do think it's safe to say to people, it is the biggest threat we have ever faced as a civilization.
Okay.
I mean, I
question.
Do. That is really, so what do you do about it, and what are the solutions? 2 kind of related questions. Once you did these and came up with the top 80, I believe,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You ranked them. And
mm-hmm.
can you give us the layman's explanation for how you ranked them?
Mm-hmm.
And the second part of that is, were there any surprises for you in terms of the solutions or the rankings? There
mm-hmm.
were for me. And
there were. Don't worry. A
couple of surprises. Wow.
Don't worry. We were all surprised on staff, and our nose was pressed to the glass for 3 years. And we thought we knew what they would be, and we were wrong. Well, we rank them according to, as I said earlier, the solutions are scaling, and either they avoid emissions, that is, by efficiency or, you know, renewable energy, or they sequester carbon. And that's the only 2 things you can do. They can either bring it home or stop putting it up there. And that includes methane and nitrous oxide and other greenhouse gases, you know. But so what we measure is, in CO2 equivalents, we measure over 30 years what the impact would be of a given solution with respect to greenhouse gases. And it's pretty conservative. We use very conservative numbers. And then that's the ranking. So which has the greatest impact is 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 and so forth. I'm not a big fan of rankings, by the way, but nevertheless, it turns out that way. And so that's on the carbon or CO2 equivalent side. And then, of course, we also measured the net cost and the net operating savings over 30 years. So we can see what are the capital flows or the capital requirements, you know, that would be needed in order to scale these over 30 years. And it turns out that it's just gigantically profitable. I'm not a big fan of the word profit either, but I want to say that it, rather than seeing it as a cost, you know, like as a diversion, you know, like, oh, okay, we have to spend money on this because, you know, these people say, you know, the Earth is warming. Actually, darn right, spend money on it because the return is extraordinary, and that discounts or doesn't even count the return in so many other ways that these solutions benefit, and we don't account for that. So that's how we rank them. And were we surprised? Absolutely. I think we were just like Al Gore and everybody else who, you know, when they stand up, and Leo DiCaprio and Bill McKibben, I mean, basically they say solar wind, and Bill, you know, Al Gore says, and Elon Musk, you know, like EVs, you know.
The great white hope.
The great white hope, and somehow if we get that, get those 3 going, you know, that we get a hall pass to the 22nd century, and those are crucial, crucial solutions, and that's also a scientific howler. That's just not true. We can get all 3 of those together and go right off the cliff, Thelma and Louise style, and so it just isn't true. And yet, I mean, those are critical solutions, but what's happened, I think, is that when we use that rhetoric, you know, about, you know, renewable energy, clean energy, and EVs, and somehow, you know, we're going to be, everything's going to be chill, no problem. It does two things. One is, not only is it not true, but the second thing is that it makes people feel like, well, I hope they do that.
Yes.
Like, because I can't put up a wind turbine, and I can't put up a solar farm, and maybe I can buy one for my roof, you know. And, yeah, I'll buy an EV when they're available and affordable, for sure, but they have to make them affordable. I can't do that. And so, in a way, it makes us all sort of objects, you know, and it disempowers us, and it just disengages us from understanding that it's a system that caused it, and it's a system that will heal it. And the way you heal any system is to connect more of it to itself. And so drawdown is very much about agency, and so people seeing that, you know, so many ways in which we can beneficially impact global warming and in what it does, you know, for us and for the land, for the sea and for children and for cities, for house, for health, for soil, for, you know, it just goes on and on and on, you know. And but we were very surprised at the final list, you know. The number one solution is refrigerant management, and we were so disappointed.
It's like, what? I know.
We were like, it is, no.
That can't be right. That can't be right. I know.
I don't want
to. That shocked me. I was like, what?
I know.
That's number one, and I'm not a scientist, but it's like, I haven't even had a show on about that. So now it's like, this is a playbook for Mrs. Green's world. And, you know, I was delightful for things like, I don't know, I loved, of course, that I think 6 and 7 maybe, or yeah, 6 and 7 were educating girls. I loved it. I did the happy dance, women and girls, and then family planning. And when you read that, and that's what I mean when I say it's a book for everyone, because you start reading them. And I think when I was talking to my friend Sally, I showed her the Silvo, the cattle, you know, growing, raising cattle in forest. So when I, excuse me, when I talk about it's exciting and it makes you want to be involved, it's the perfect segue for my next question, because I took this from the book. There's a message about why it's important for all of us to change our story from global warming is happening to us to global warming is happening for us. And you frame these things so well. Help reframe that for us. Why is it important that we change the conversation and say it's happening for us? Because you can believe those words never came out of my mouth till I read the book.
Well, there's two basic reasons. One is that if you think it's happening to you, then you feel like I'm the object, I'm the victim,
right.
I didn't
right.
plan this, this wasn't my idea.
Powerless, yes.
I'm powerless, and these bad people and oil companies and are doing this, and they shouldn't do it. And, you know, you're looking outside of yourself for, you know, for the cause. And then basically, that's your mind. That's the world you live in. You're living in a world where you are victimized, or some, you know, word comparable to that, you know, where you, you know.
And you feel powerless. It's like, I can't do anything.
Well, you don't feel powerful.
Right, you don't feel powerful. Right.
No, and you don't feel. But if it's happening for you, then you think, well, wait a minute, this is happening for me means that I am the subject, you know, which is, and when you understand that, you take 100% responsibility, you stop blaming people, and you start really thinking, okay, what do I want my life to mean? What am I going to do, you know, in terms of imagination, innovation, creativity, activity, you know, you come alive with that. And the reason it's happening for us, though, is scientific, which is that every system that denies or ignores feedback perishes. That's just the law.
Wow.
And, you know, so when you get, like, a fever or this or that, or all of a sudden there's a, you know, your skin breaks out, you have some allergy or whatever it is, that's feedback. And then you, like, oh, wait a minute, what's going on here? And then you try to figure out what's the cause. And you eliminate the cause because you want to stick around and be here. So the global warming is feedback from a system, this extraordinary atmospheric system, which is created by life. The atmosphere is created by plants. And now this is feedback. And so that feedback is a blessing because it actually leads to a transformation of the world as opposed to being something we want to combat and fight. And so it's actually not just for you, it's actually a blessing. It's a kindness. It's a generosity. It's like you're just seeing it completely differently. Like, thank you. I don't want anybody to suffer. That's not what I'm saying.
I hope you take this as a huge compliment, but that's like a Noam Chomsky answer. You should add to your list philosopher, because what he does is bring out that other piece of deeper thinking. So that, and I think that's a message that all of us human beings can hear. Why is that so important? It's feedback from the universe, and it's an amazing observation. And you should add philosopher. So tell your PR people to add author, activist, and philosopher. But that's a very thoughtful, on purpose answer that certainly gives me pause and something to think about. So, and kind of along that line, in the foreword of the book, Tom Steyer, who's the founder and president from Next Gen Climate, he writes that Paul Hawken and the Project Drawdown team give us a roadmap with a moral compass, an extensively researched view of the future we can build together. How's the book a moral compass?
Well, I didn't write that. I have to ask Tom.
You know what? If you can help me get him on the show, I'm on it. I'm all on it. He's another hero.
I think it's a moral compass in the sense that, remember I said I don't want anybody to suffer. I don't think anybody wants anybody to suffer. I don't think, you know, humans are very good that way, actually. Not to say they don't cause a lot of suffering, but I mean, saying is on a personal level, no one really wants to do that unless they're sociopaths. And I think that, you know, so it draws out of us, you know, this need to care. You know, we do really care. We care for our children. We're so good with animals. You know, we're so good with pets. You know,
right.
We are caring people. And so essentially this feedback is about, okay, now how can I care? You know, it's like, how can I take care? And what I think we do in Drawdown is to break it down so that it's not like you don't have to save the world. That's the world's problem. That's not your problem. What you have to do is save yourself. And save yourself is to change your mind.
Got it.
And
yes.
Changing your mind sees yourself as absolutely integrated in this extraordinary, miraculous, beautiful thing called life. And what we see in life is that it's a self-organizing system. It doesn't have a manager. It doesn't have a president. It doesn't have a CEO. There's nobody in charge. And that's so cool. And nobody's in charge of your body either, by the
right,
way.
Right, right.
You feed your body. You feed it, so you nourish it, okay, but the actual workings of the body are not under your control. And so the same thing with our planet and so forth. So really what Drawdown is about is trying to be generous. No, the roads don't lead to us. All roads lead out. We're trying to provide information and research, you know, that helps people everywhere self-organize around reversing global warming, and that's actually what's happening all over the world.
And, you know, you are so sought after in terms of this book, your wisdom, the things that you've done. And I say that it's a very high compliment. And the reason why is because of the answers that you give and what you're putting forth for all of us. So this question is to help me and to help others in the story. How do we get people? What do you say to try to get people to understand that global warming is not a liberal agenda, it's not a conservative one, but it's a human agenda, especially now in the very politically charged attack the environment agenda coming from the White House? I mean, I feel like there's an attack a day on the environment, and I don't want to fuel that. I want it to be a human agenda because it does impact all of us.
The way you do that is just by being very human. You know, the people ask me, well, how do you deal with deniers or people who, you know, all that sort of stuff?
Right. Right.
And I said, I don't do anything at all. Why should I do anything about that? When's the last time you wanted somebody to change your mind?
Right. That's what Catherine Hayhoe says. She said, I just don't do anything.
No, I don't want to try to change somebody's mind. What I want to do is provide possibility. And people move to possibility. And so really drawdown is about imagination, about like just really reflecting back to the world that what's possible going forward. I mean, the next book is called Regeneration, you know. And it's also about process and about, you know, the world we can live in as we go forward, you know, when we adopt these solutions, you know, and because they're all in process, there's no one, it's not like you can do one solution, it's all about a system. So, for me, you know, I mean, when somebody is that way about it, I just listen. I want to learn from somebody. If somebody thinks, you know, whatever they think that's, you know, counter scientific, for example, you know, I'm not going to try to beat them back with facts, because that facts don't change beliefs.
It won't work. Right.
Well, it just doesn't work.
Right. Doesn't work.
In fact, it ossifies beliefs, actually.
Yeah.
So what I want to do is be the listener and learn. And, you know, I had an audience of people who I knew I was sort of placed there by management to talk to people who I knew did not believe in so-called believe in climate change and all that sort of stuff. And so that was the first question I asked them. I said, look, how many of you don't believe in climate science or the idea that human activity is causing global warming? Just raise your hand. And first, you know, nobody wants to raise their hand. It's okay. No.
It's okay. I'm not judging.
You know, you don't have to say anything. I'm not going to call on you and so forth, you know, but just, you know, it's okay. You know, it's fine, whatever you think. And so people raise their hand, you know. And then I say, okay. And in this case, they were all supply chain executives, okay? And I said, all of them. And I said, well, you all should have raised your hand, because science is not a belief system.
It's
evidentiary. And I said, how many of you, because you control supply chains of these large corporations, you know, and you depend on SAP or Oracle software, and it's all about data, right? And said, how many of you would change and do something because somebody said, look, I don't believe we should order this product right now, or this is a good vendor? You think, believe? Get out of here. It's all data. And drawdown is all about data. That's what we did, you know. We did the math. And this is data. It's not about belief at all. And so in a way, it just takes away... It kind of made the people raise their hand actually feel good, because they don't believe. I said, right. Don't believe that. It's crazy to believe it.
I bet they were surprised at what Paul Hawkins said.
Yeah.
Seriously, yeah. That would have been a nice to be a fly on the wall and observe that. It's brilliant, though. It really is. It's brilliant. They're not on the attack mode. You have them listening.
I'm not attacking them.
No. Yeah, and that really matters. So we have to wrap up, because I know your time is precious, and we have Catherine Wilkinson coming on, who is just amazing, the senior writer for Project Drawdown. I just want to ask one last question.
Yeah.
Can you articulate your greatest hopes for this living, breathing, critically important work to have a ripple effect around the world? You're already seeing it, yes?
Yeah, it's going into 11 languages this year. I think... like Arabic and Vietnamese, Finnish.
Awesome. It's amazing. Because that good.
Somebody asked me, he said, what's your 15-year goal? You know, like, mm-hmm. What was it? I said, oh, that's easy. And I said, well, what? And I said, well, that in 15 years, the term and the activity around drawdown is ubiquitous everywhere in the world. You know, it's like, duh. And nobody knows where it came from.
Oh my gosh, that's really, I got goosebumps. You passed the goosebump test. It's like, what an answer, Paul Hawken.
Yeah.
So thank you for taking the time, for what you've done to contribute to our planet and to our health and to Mother Earth. And it's just been an honor and a privilege, and I appreciate it. I know how jammed your schedule is, and I can't wait to spend some time talking with Catherine. She's amazing. I mean, I heard her speak twice.
She's an astonishing woman.
She is. She is, yeah. Really. She's all that. She's a new rock star for me. So everybody,
let's talk again, and let's talk about women in climate, because that is a really, really important subject, and maybe that's another interview.
Well, thank you for bringing that up, because we talked a little bit before air, and I'm writing an op-ed about there are so many amazing women in the climate change conversation, and they are underrepresented in all of the media. And I'm going to say all, because who is quoted? It's you know, pretty much white male scientists, and I don't have anything against them at all, but it's so out of balance. So that is another
exclusion.
Great... Every time we exclude
and move away from diversity, whether it's gender or racial or genetic or cultural, whatever it is, so forth, you know, we lose. And the climate movement has been a white male-dominated movement, and that has to stop.
And Catherine's raising her voice about that, and I love it. And so is Diana Liverman, and it's just like, this is not the whole story. I felt that way about An Inconvenient, you know, Truth to Power. That's not really the story. It wasn't Al Gore and Elon Musk who saved the Paris Agreement. It just wasn't. And I know people who know better. And it disappointed me, because there's a lot of good things in that. But it's like, come on, dude, seriously, there were women there making important things happen at the highest levels. So now you have my dander up. It's like,
and saving the Paris Agreement. The Paris Agreement is about 2C, right? About holding temperature to 2C in 2050, as if that was science-based. That number was pulled out of thin air by Richard Nordhaus in 1975. Oh. And it's not science-based. And he admits it. And then Joachim Schellenhuber in Germany came up with the same one in 1994, unaware of Richard Nordhaus for the German ministry. He, too, says he pulled out of thin air, just to make it simple. And the fact is that the Paris Agreement, you know, you can't get here from there. Al Gore can save it all day long, but the fact is that the humanity does not respond to future existential threat. And so the Paris Agreement is about 2050. And you know, I've challenged people to say, okay, now go outside now after my talk, go to a sidewalk, and go to people, person after person, and say, what does 2C, 2 degrees Celsius, mean in Fahrenheit? Second, what does it mean in 2050? Do you know what that means in 2050? Does it bother you? Is that something that, you know, people just look at you like you're nuts.
Right, like you landed
and
from Mars.
So using 2C as a way to motivate people is like saying, you know, there should be more popsicle sticks in the world, you know, and you go, huh? Why? I mean, it just doesn't catch, you know. Talk to a woman in Botswana, or somebody, a bricklayer in Belgium, you know, or a fisherman in Boston, and say, 2C, 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 it is meaningless.
Right.
And the climate establishment is using words and using goals that disengage 99%
not relatable.
Of people are not relatable.
Not relatable. And that's the difference with Project Drawdown. And you can tell I'm so sincere in saying that. I have, you know, stickies all over the books, and it'll be part of a roadmap for the shows that we do in the future. We're doing our whole month of May is on women climate scientists. That's what we're dedicating.
Oh my gosh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, that's what we're dedicating May to. So thank you again so much, and for spending some extra time with me. And I'll see you in May.
Okay,
lovely. Everybody, stay tuned.
Okay,
Catherine Wilkinson up next. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thank you for joining us. We just enjoyed an informative interview with Paul Hawken, the project director, editor, and writer for Project Drawdown. And now we get to spend another 30 minutes with the person responsible for putting it all together on many levels. And that is the truth. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Catherine Wilkinson, senior writer for Project Drawdown, Previously, Catherine was director of strategy at the purpose consultancy Bright House. She also taught at the University of Oxford and worked for the Natural Resources Defense Council and the Boston Consulting Group. Based on her doctoral research at Oxford, Catherine published Between God and Green, and I cannot wait to read that one, How Evangelicals Are Cultivating a Middle Ground on Climate Change, called a vitally important, even subversive story by the Boston Globe, which makes me want to read it even more. She holds a PhD in geography and environment from Oxford, where she was a Rhodes Scholar, and a BA in religion from Suwannee, the University of the South, where she was a Udall Scholar and valedictorian. So you can already tell we're going to have an underachiever. So Catherine, I just have to throw that in. But when you read all that, I just have to. And I can't do it without laughing knowing you, because you're so not that person that walks around, oh yes, I went to Oxford and I'm a Rhodes Scholar. Such a down-to-earth, engaging, wonderful human being. So, and I can attest to the fact that she is one of the most delightful and engaging human beings, in addition to the list of these most impressive accomplishments. So Catherine, it's wonderful to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Gina. It's great to be with you all virtually from my treehouse in Atlanta. And I think I'm a recovering overachiever. So,
wait a minute. We have to talk. You really are in a treehouse. Did the guy on TV build the treehouse?
Well, it's treehouse is maybe a little bit of a stretch. My condo sits at kind of canopy level in the forest that is the city of Atlanta. So if I get distracted at any point, we'll blame it on like a hawk.
Right. We'll know that there's a Harris hawk or something out there distracting you. So anyway, well, we just had an amazing interview with Paul Hawken for the first part of the show. And even with all of his sharing, it's still challenging to get your head around the magnitude and scope of this massive global project that Drawdown represents. So how do you describe Project Drawdown?
I think that's fair. It is massive and sprawling in many ways. So I often say that Drawdown is sort of three things in one. So it's the nonprofit, Project Drawdown, which of course is led by Paul. And the work of that nonprofit is focused on mapping, measuring, modeling, and communicating the most substantive solutions to global warming. It's also a book. I'm sure you all talked about that as well. Drawdown, the most comprehensive plan ever proposed to reverse global warming, which came out last year. And I think about the book as being sort of a snapshot of the work of the nonprofit, this living research and communication project. And then Drawdown with a lowercase d is also a really crucial goal for humanity, of actually getting to that threshold, that point in time when we are pulling more greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere than we're sending up into it on a year-to-year basis.
So that's the thing that I love about it, is the point that you made about it is a book, but it's also a living, breathing, growing document. I mean, it can be somewhat of the go-to place for solutions for climate reality, and it will continue to grow and expand through the website.
Absolutely. That is our aspiration. So you can imagine a book and a set of models behind it that don't continue to evolve. You know, at some point they sort of fall by the wayside and aren't able to continue to influence the conversation. So it's very important that we continue the modeling, we continue to pull in new data, new research, and update those projections of what these different solutions can do for us between now and mid-century. And it's also important to continue updating the various kind of containers for that work. And the book is one of them. So we anticipate that there will be a second edition perhaps coming out next year, as well as some other ways we'll be sharing the work.
I can't even imagine that. I mean, the book is, it's big for one thing, but it is content, it's content rich. And I, what I want to say to our listeners is it's not a science book. It is and it isn't. It's everything's there for the scientist, but everything's there for the concerned, evolved citizen about solutions. And it's in plain English, as I say, it's not written in science. You can understand where the research comes from, you know, what the climate impact will be in pounds of carbon and all of that. But for our listeners, if you care about the planet, read about these solutions, which is a perfect segue to my next question. you put it together, the vast amount of science and information about where we really are as a planet and the climate reality. What are your thoughts about, this is a subject where there's so much gloom and threats and fear and perspective around climate change. How does that serve us? Will that get us anywhere? What are your thoughts on that?
So I can speak to this from a very personal perspective, actually, which is I was finishing up my PhD really kind of in the thick of the last push of that work in 2009. Which was a hard year for climate action, especially in the U.S. It looked like we had maybe the best chance in a generation to pass federal climate policy, and we got it through the House, and we couldn't get it through the Senate. And there was this kind of collective bottoming out that you could feel. And I was thinking about, you know, what next after grad school, and I just thought, I don't know how to stay in the doom and gloom of the science and the problem statement day to day and stay sane. And I couldn't figure out kind of the right alchemy for me professionally for that. And I think in some ways, you know, I felt sort of heartbroken. And ended up stepping away from work on climate for a few years. But I continued to be tugged at, I guess, by a sense of responsibility, a sense of possibility. And I was feeling that tug quite strongly when Paul and I met, actually. And when he shared the work of Drawdown, which was just maybe a couple of years into its existence at that point, I felt really moved, both from kind of an intellectual perspective, someone who had been looking at this landscape of climate communication and action in my PhD research and seeing the limitations of this doom and gloom kind of dominant discourse around climate. But also personally, you know, I thought, oh, this feels like the kind of work I could imagine reinvesting my time and my mind and my heart in.
And you did.
And I did.
That's the wonder of it. So the book, to me, is a pick-me-up, because when I am feeling down, I can open a page and read about solutions. And I just would like to talk a little bit about some of the solutions, and maybe you could explain them better than I can. But the book, you actually ranked them in terms of impact, from what I understand, about if we this would be the impact. So one of them that just jumped out at me, and it might crack you up, that this is one that I loved, was silvopasture. And to me, it was fascinating on so many levels. Can you tell us about that and what its impact would be and, you know, why it draws down carbon?
Yes. So silvopasture is also one of the solutions that that I love as well. I hate to say favorites because they sort of all feel like my little chickadees.
Right. You can't say that, but I can.
But I do love silvopasture. In some ways, just because it's something that so few people have heard about, and yet it clocks in at number 9 on the list of solutions, which is pretty interesting. So the word silvopasture comes from the Latin words for forest and grazing, and conventional wisdom, you know, would sort of tell us that trees and cows, they don't mix.
Right.
But actually what we see is that, in fact, these integrated systems of livestock and trees actually have been around for a long time. In some cases, this is quite an ancient practice. And you can imagine from a farmer's perspective why this might be a great recipe, right? You're raising cows, maybe you're raising a nut or a fruit. Maybe you're also able to harvest for timber. So you've got multiple products going that you're going to be able to take to market at different times. And the system itself ends up being more resilient to drought or other forms of extreme weather. But from a greenhouse gas emissions perspective, which of course is the context under which you get on the list for drawdown, if you compare a pasture with trees to a pasture without trees, the pasture with trees will sequester 5 to 10 times more carbon. And it does that through the incredible technology of photosynthesis, right? This is one of nature's kind of most successful outcomes of 3.8 billion years of research and development. That plants are incredibly adept at taking carbon dioxide and then holding that carbon in the biomass of the plant or sending it into the soil. So silvopasture ends up as number 9 on the list with the potential to reduce just over 31 gigatons of carbon dioxide over 30 years because of that power of sequestration.
And it's a perfect example of why someone would want to get this book. I mean, that's delightful on the level of learning about it, and impactful on the level of what the impact can be. I mean, it was just, to me, I picked it out. And of course, not surprising to you or anyone who knows me, coming in at number 6 and 7, 6 is educating women and girls, and 7 is family planning. And that might surprise some people. It did not me, because of my work in the environment. But how does educating women and girls impact CO2 emissions and help with carbon drawdown?
Yes, this is one I think that sometimes surprises folks. They're expecting to see solar panels and electric vehicles.
Right.
They're maybe not expecting to see, there's a beautiful photograph in the book of a young woman who is in school in Kenya, and it's one of my favorite photographs, which is perhaps the other thing to say as an aside about the book, both that I think it's very accessible, as you've said, Gina, but it's also quite beautiful. There's beautiful photography and imagery that bring these solutions to life. So how did it end up there? There are about 130 million girls around the world who are of school age but are not in school today. And of course, you can imagine why that is a challenge we want to address for so many reasons. When we see girls stay in school and finish what we would consider high school, they have higher wages and better upward mobility, maternal and infant mortality drops. They're less likely to be forced into marriage. They have lower rates of HIV, AIDS, and malaria, on and on and on and on. It is such a powerful intervention for addressing poverty and improving lives. But it also turns out that with more years of education, women choose to have fewer children. They more actively manage their reproductive health, right? Deciding how many children do I want to have and when do I want to have them. And the children that they do have are healthier. So if you add that up, right, globally and over 3 decades, what you end up with by 2050, which is what our models look at. That's the window between now and 2050. You would have fewer feet making their carbon footprints by the middle of the century. So educating girls and family planning are these really tightly woven solutions. They're kind of the two ways into shifting fertility rates. And I think what's really important about how we address these particular topics in Drawdown is that it comes totally from the perspective of women's fundamental rights and empowerment and opportunity and well-being. So when we pursue women's rights and gender equity, it turns out that those things have really positive ripple effects for the planet as well. And I think it's worth just calling out how very different that is than some of the ways these topics have been addressed in the environmental movement in decades past, which have been much more about these ideas of controlling population as opposed to empowering women to make the choices that best suit their and their families' lives and to address the things that they say they want and don't have.
What a wonderful answer. I mean, it's just about the education piece and not forcing or inflicting and saying you can only have two children. It's it's a systemic approach as opposed to an imposed one. And of course, you know where I would weigh in on that one. So
exactly.
I worked hard to frame this question, but then I decided there's no dancing around it, and it's who I am. I've read about and interviewed and heard presentations from some of the world's brightest women when it comes to climate change, climate reality, climate science. But from what I observed in the mainstream media, I'm just going to say, one might think men were the only ones involved in climate science at times. And then, you know, I'm kind of doing a check-in with you to say, is that fair or accurate? But even when you Google it, I mean, you have to Google top women climate scientists, because if you just Google top climate scientists when we're doing our research. So is that fair, accurate, and is it changing? What's your sense of that?
That's such a great question, Gina. And it can, you know, sometimes I go to kind of climate focused gatherings, and it feels a bit like old white guys on parade, and they're wonderful.
They are. That is not to minimize. You're right.
Yeah, but we want to see, I think, a greater diversity of leadership and voices on this issue, precisely because it is an issue that affects all of us, and that we really need to tap all of our collective wisdom to address. I'm embarrassed to say I haven't read it yet, but my PhD supervisor, who you know, in Tucson, Diana Liberman, and one of her, another former PhD student of hers, just published a paper about women in climate science. So for those who are hungry for some statistics about the experiences of those women working in this space, that would be a good resource. I think we have work to do still, and I think it's incredibly important to continue lifting up more diverse, younger voices in this space and inviting those perspectives into the core of the conversation. It's been really meaningful to me since Drawdown got published to share this work in various public forums, and especially to hear from young women who experience that as an invitation for themselves to then step into thinking and speaking and acting on these topics, or to double down on things they may already be doing.
So that is a great answer to that. And another tricky question: pretty much all the climate scientists I am aware of, and I admit, look at the place from which I come, trying to incorporate diversity, but it's coming from my perspective. Climate change impacts marginalized communities, and poor communities usually first. So you have,
yes.
you know, white people, white men and women reporting on this. So you have people in these marginalized communities. Most of them are people of color. And my thought was, drawdown helps to mitigate that because of the global contributions from so many diverse populations. Is that a fair conclusion on my part?
Well, it's certainly something that that our team strived for, particularly in putting together the drawdown research fellowship. So we had over 60 research fellows who worked on this project at one point or another, and they are 40% women, and they come from 22 countries, 6 continents. I think Paul was really thoughtful about, hey, look, if this is just a team that's, you know, sitting in the bubble of the Bay Area, we're going to miss things, right? And we're not going to bring a kind of adequately full perspective to this work. But also, who would take us seriously, right? There's a credibility question, I think, as well, that's really, really important. And certainly, I think the ultimate product of this book very much benefited from the rich mosaic of the team behind it.
It made me feel really great about that and looking at it. This is really a global solution, not something a few people sat around and thought, oh, this might work. It was such a collaborative effort, and really seeing the planet as a planet, not different countries.
Right.
It's a very different
That's
perspective.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes. And I think it's, you know, part of the joy of this project was getting to reflect back to all of humanity what we already know, what we have already been working on, the toolbox we have developed. We have an incredible plan to get to drawdown. We just didn't know we had it because
right,
it hadn't been pulled together in this way and in a way that anyone can take a look and see that toolbox and begin to understand it and think about how might they want to engage.
Great answer also. And I just have one kind of Debbie Downer question, and then we'll go on to the ending the show in an up note. But there are times when my fear is on steroids and I am paralyzed a little bit when I read what our current administration is consistently, the steps they're taking in their environmental policies. The potential really does exist for so much damage to be done. And I just want to know from your perspective as a scientist, do things like eviscerating the EPA and allowing for offshore drilling to increase and doing away with the Clean Water Plan, that is just ingenious. Will it cause irreversible damage? And what would your call to action be for people who care about preservation? I mean, it could, I keep saying, if we can stop things, then it won't be irreversible. But when you look at parts of British Columbia and the tar sands, that's done. Mm-hmm. Like, it's toast.
Yeah.
And parts of the Ecuadorian rainforest and the Peruvian rainforest, done. They're not growing those trees again. So you're not a fear-based person. Tell us why we shouldn't be afraid, Catherine. That's not a big responsibility.
Yeah. Well, I certainly won't pretend that I don't have days when I'm afraid. I have a young goddaughter who I adore, you know, and
yes.
I try to imagine sometimes, you know, what will the world look like when she's my age or beyond. And it can be hard, you know, to hold, I think, the realities of what is happening. And I return again and again and again to this concept of Parker Palmer's. Parker Palmer is this wonderful Quaker thought leader, activist, author, teacher. And he talks about the tragic gap. And I think tragic is an appropriate word, but it is really hard to stay in the space between seeing what's happening and bearing witness to that, the hard stuff, right? and also holding a vision of what's possible, and that there is work to stay in the work, right?
Yes.
We have to kind of actively choose the tragic gap again and again, because ultimately you could sort of flip out one side into depression or another into cynicism, or another into just kind of, I don't really want to think about this, gee whiz optimism. But I think that for me, it is always harder to be out of the tragic gap than in it. And when you're in it and in the work that is itself good, right? Even though we don't know what the outcomes of our efforts will be, the work itself is good. The work itself is a way to bear witness to a reverence for life, right? And this incredible planet that we call home, and this human species that is capable of being so remarkable, even as we are capable of really screwing some things up. So I think about that, and I give myself a break by remembering that it takes work to stay in the work, and that getting outside and in a community of kindred spirits, and sometimes going to some good poets for inspiration, can be the things that help me stay there.
Another wonderful, thoughtful, hopeful answer. So if you can believe this, we have less than 2 minutes. So what I would like to do is invite you back, and I will definitely talk to Kelly about that, because I would love to talk about Between God and Green, how evangelicals are cultivating a middle ground on climate change. I think we have to find the middle ground, the middle of the Venn diagram, and continue to find ways to come to the table together in a civilized way, which we used to be able to. It wasn't too long ago in my lifetime that even the House and Senate were not a house divided on climate change, because it protects all of us. All of the information that you want to find out about Catherine in this write-up and ways to get Project Drawdown, which the easiest way is Amazon. I personally would recommend going to your local bookstore, which is what I did, and they ordered it for me, because I would love people to use Amazon less and their local bookstores more. So if you can, think about that and put it on your list. And on April 19th, Julia Strange and Mary Atkinson from Tucson Medical Center to discuss what it means to be a true community partner. And April 24th, Jamie Beck and her father, Glenn Beck, not the Fox Glenn Beck, everybody, about Green Biz and their relationship about being environmentalists. Catherine Wilkinson, thank you. You are a rock star.
You are also a rock star, Gina. This has been lovely. Thank you.
Thank you.